This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. George Washington commented on the imperfections of the Constitution in 1787, saying, quote, "The remedy must come hereafter." Thomas Jefferson gave the Constitution 19 years before it should be revised because, quote, "The earth belongs always to the living generation." It's not easy to change the U.S. Constitution. After all, there are only 27 amendments since it was written during a hot and humid summer in Philadelphia more than 200 years ago. But that didn't stop our guest, Kevin Blyer. He took on the task of not just reading the entire document, but revising it in a new book called Me, the People, One Man's Selfless Quest to Rewrite the Constitution of the United States of America. Blyer is an Emmy Award-winning writer for The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. He's written humorous speeches for President Obama, including ones given at the annual correspondence dinner. He's also a term member of the Council on Foreign Relations. And Kevin Blyer joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. Nice to have you with us.
It's nice to be here. Happy to be a one-man remedy, as George Washington might have suggested.
Indeed. So do you have delusions of grandeur?
Oh, don't I ever? Can't you tell?
Yes.
I think the mere title of my book would imply that, yes, of course, I'm entirely delusional in rewriting the Constitution all by myself. But as you said, no less than Thomas Jefferson told me that I had to. Every 19 years. So by his math, it should have been rewritten 11 times by now. Forgive me for just getting to it.
Right, exactly. Well, we will forgive you for that. But you actually have read the U.S. Constitution, and I think seriously, most people in this country have not.
You are not incorrect. In fact, I have read it. That was my first moment of research, was going to the National Archives and reading the thing top to bottom. But you're right. One in four Americans actually ever recall having ever read the Constitution. Mm. And when they did, they probably did it under some duress. I'm sure it was an assignment in high school, which, of course, leads us all to have some rather unfortunate blind spots about what's actually in the Constitution. It is the case of a study of a few years ago that, unfortunately, more American teenagers can name the Three Stooges than can name the three branches of government. And this is American teenagers and the Three Stooges. It's not exactly Justin Bieber material. This is, you know, so in other words, you have to go dig pretty deep for teenagers to understand that. And then, of course, that also works for adults as well. We have some pretty big blind spots about what actually is in the Constitution.
Well, we will get to how you have fixed it for us. But it is often confused with the Declaration of Independence. I think House Speaker John Boehner misquoted.
Pretty famously, a few years ago, yes, he held up. He, in fact, even held up a copy of his pocket constitution and said, "I stand with the founders who wrote in the preamble of the Constitution, we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal." Unfortunately, as we now know, now that I've done the research, that is, in fact, in the Declaration of Independence. Now, I should say, I cast no aspersions. I mean this sincerely, because I'm certain that my blind spots were as big as his and as the rest of the country. Had you asked me, I'm sure I would have been convinced that the Constitution begins with, "It was the best of times, it was the worst of times." And to some degree, that's actually true. I suppose it was.
And it still is true, I think.
I suppose it is true. So maybe that would be as good of a rewrite as any.
And not to throw a wet blanket on our discussion here, but at the same time, is there also something serious about this, which is to get us to pay attention to this important document?
Precisely. If I can do anything as, a satirist, I suppose, it's that I would hope that rewriting the Constitution in some entertaining way and dipping deep as I have in researching what was actually in it might get people, I suppose, to go back to the source code, so to speak, to actually think, well, I'll go ahead and read it. It's not that long. It's only 4,000 words, 7,000 if you count the amendments. Granted, it's not the most riveting read. There's a little bit of language that might be a little dense, but I think you'll be surprised at how many of those phrases kind of pop back up and you think, oh, I've heard that before. Mm-hmm. This is pretty interesting. Now, you don't have to do what I did, which is go to the National Archives and elbow aside some tourists and six-year-olds and read the entire actual document, because I felt like a lot of people can say they read the Constitution, but how many people can say they read the Constitution? But go ahead and, read it. Heck, you know, Google it. It's all there. It's all there.
Well, I'm holding a little pocket edition of the U.S. Constitution.
Well, if you quote it, I'll assume you don't get it wrong, like Mr. John Boehner, unfortunately.
Yes. Exactly. I'd love to have you actually read a press release that you write, and I should say to our listeners, there's a quill in the copy of Kevin Blyer's edition of his book.
Occupational Hazard. It's my bookmark. Of course, I this quill that you're referring to, and yes, I have it in my hand here. I plucked off a goose in Greece. Now your listeners will have to decide if I'm being truthy or truthful there. But yes, there's a quill that I have in my hand. But you're right. I decided that I had to essentially actually announce to the world what I was about to do. I had to basically put out a press release, and as you say, it goes a little bit like this. I'm on my way to Philadelphia. That's what this revolution needs, a press release. So with only 30 miles to go, with Philadelphia as my North Star and I-95 as my set course, with a slightly bumpy voyage only the framers could appreciate, naturally, I presume Thomas Jefferson wrote his draft on horseback, and with the recent revelation that my laptop has maybe 20 minutes of juice left tops, I quickly compose my Declaration of Independence from the unlikeliest of tyrants, the American Constitution. For immediate release. When, in the course of human events, well, seems as good an intro as any, definitely worth borrowing, it becomes necessary for one man, that's me, to dissolve, dismantle, and discard the political bands which have, let's face it, been duteously discredited and duly discounted, a little heavy on the alliteration, but it'll do, and offer his boundless wisdom, bountiful insight, and rhetorical eloquence on behalf of an entire nation, I'm really rolling now, necessity demands that he rewrite the Constitution of these United States of America. Nice touch, I think. This isn't me demanding. This is necessity. A new covenant need be written, and should be written, and shall be written, and that one man, I hesitate for a moment, why be coy, and that Kevin J. Blyer, affirmed gentleman, scholar, penman, wordsmith, mathlete, world traveler, prospective homeowner, hopeless romantic, deep thinker, infamous scribbler, award-winning satirist, peerless leader, oh, am I coming on too strong, and humble servant, oh, much better, shall be the one to write it. So far, so good. But is it enough? I don't know. Seems short.
And that's Kevin Blyer reading from his book, his press release for the new Constitution of the United States, the book called Me, the People. You're also poking fun at the founders not so far from here. That was a hot summer, hot, humid summer.
On a day like this, especially, right?
So we can, although we don't have the wigs and all the
right.
The clothing that they had to wear, that this was a rowdy bunch.
It was a rowdy bunch, and it was, as you say, a sweltering summer. A rowdy bunch, I mean, they... You know, as you say, they wore powdered wigs, they were cloistered, there was no air conditioning at the time, they had shuttered the doors, they had closed the windows for privacy.
Right.
Truly, they were, the butchers were throwing animal carcasses out into the street not far. There was a prison riot across the street in Philadelphia. It is not exactly the most perfect circumstances for rational thinking. Add to that, they were drinking beer for breakfast. Now, I tell you this, everyone was drinking beer for breakfast.
I was going to say, a lot of people did that.
Because it was safer than water at the time. But nonetheless, the fact remains, they were drinking beer for breakfast. Some of them drank so much, Luther Martin, for example, that he was known for giving many hour speeches on the floor that more than once actually seemed to might derail the convention from the get-go. They were arguing. They were all very proud people. Of course, they thought they knew best. And so there was 4 months of argument. They didn't actually really come to a compromise, the great compromise, until the very end of the summer. And when, in fact, they did finally come to that compromise, even the most founding fathers, George Washington, Ben Franklin, said things like, I believe George Washington, as you said earlier, said, I wished it had been made more perfect. Ben Franklin famously said that I could stomach it only with all its faults. So they knew that they were making a compromise, didn't know that it would last forever. And of course, we should revere it, and we should absolutely be proud of the fact that it's lasted so long. But they themselves might have suggested that it might have been have a more broad expiration date.
But what you're also saying is that it is not the sacred document that I think some have believed that it is.
I think that's a fair thing to say. I mean, when I look back, and I think even the founders themselves were, of course, happy to get out of Philadelphia, to be done, and to go around the country and try to ratify it. I don't think they, you know, certainly they were, I think they felt it was inspired, but one wonders if they would have thought it was sacred, that's for certain.
You described it as more Etch-a-Sketch than hallowed blueprint. Did you say Etch-a-Sketch before that got into the news recently?
Well, shucks. I did, in fact.
Did you?
I wrote that a while back, so I was surprised to see that it became such a touchstone recently. Mm-hmm. Happy to see that it comes back in vogue. Heck, I like an Etch-a-Sketch. I grew up with one myself.
Did you?
But it is the case that, yes, they were truly reframing and redesigning the design of government a number of times before August and September came. It wasn't, well, let's design the executive, now we know that. Now let's design the judiciary, now we know that. Let's design the legislature, now we know that. Not at all. They were starting over from scratch a number of times, in part because they had actually established committees, the way they ran the delegation themselves, the convention themselves, is that anyone could bring up anything that had already been decided on for reconsideration. Mm-hmm. So when you think about that, and you're dealing with dozens of guys, certainly, you know, anytime you decide on one thing, the other someone's going to pipe in and say, well, now that I don't feel so strong about this, but I feel strong the thing we discussed last week, I want to start over again.
Talk about etch-a-sketch,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
But are there words in this Constitution that still inspire you?
Absolutely. I mean, look, you can't – I mean, the Constitution inspires me. I don't want to give away the ending too much, but the butler didn't do it here. Of course, I do make comic hay out of, you know, the suggestions we might reframe, fix, you know, eliminate the errors left behind. But it is an amazing document, no surprise there. If I had to pick one thing in particular, of course, you look at the preamble. It's an incredibly aspirational thing. The only – redesign that I did for the preamble, and I think people might appreciate this, is I made it rhyme, naturally. But I still list out all the things that the preamble, of course, suggests. We do want domestic tranquility. We do want a common defense. All of those things are important, and of course, I suggested as much. Now, you won't be surprised to also hear that I'm pretty proud of the First Amendment, because it is how, actually, I make my living, so to speak.
Indeed,
so
indeed.
I don't
I think
make
we're all
yeah, exactly.
happy with the First
fair
Amendment.
Fair enough. I don't make too many changes than that, other than be a little more specific about how it might actually serve us, yes.
Well, you also say, and we quoted a couple of presidents there, Jefferson and Washington, is that while presidents, and we all talk about this hallowed document, many presidents have ignored the Constitution, including Thomas Jefferson himself.
I think the point of the Constitution is that it's supposed to be honored and revered, and it is, but it's also, in to some degree, it's a guidepost. It's supposed to be tested, so to speak, to see what you can do to progress the country. And yes, famously, Thomas Jefferson, when he decided to go ahead with the Louisiana Purchase, knew he was doing something extra-constitutional. He actually said it explicitly. I recognize that this might be extra-constitutional, but I'm doing it for, and these are his words, our own good. I'm doing it for the good of the country. So at some point, he thought, well, you know what? I could double the size of the country. I think everyone will be proud of me when I do it. I think the Americans that fill the western the western half might ultimately be thankful for the fact that I did something so, quote-unquote extra-constitutional. Mm. And it is the case. Yes, you look through history. They're not all positive stories, but nonetheless, that's been kind of the obligation, is to see what the Constitution allows us to do. We saw that just last week. We saw that, you know, we had the ACA was approved by a 5-4 majority.
The Affordable Care Act.
Exactly, the Affordable Care Act. You know, for 2 years at least, we were debating whether or not this is extra constitutional. The Supreme Court said, no, it is not. So that debate, in a sense, has been stamped as something that exists now and is constitutional. And, you know, it follows in the lines of in the footsteps of, you know, the long ago footsteps of Thomas Jefferson.
Well, on that note, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Kevin Blyer. He has rewritten the U.S. Constitution and titled his book, Me, the People. And he is a writer for The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. He's written for President Obama for some of those speeches given at the annual Correspondents' Dinner. And he's a term member of the Council on Foreign Relations. We're talking about the U.S. Constitution and what to do about it. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Cancer Treatment Centers of America in Philadelphia proudly supports WHYY, providing comprehensive cancer care for patients fighting complex or advanced stage cancers. Cancer Treatment Centers of America in Philadelphia offers treatment options like intraoperative radiation therapy. This therapy delivers radiation during surgery to help reduce treatment time and get patients back to their lives faster. More at cancercenter.com.
There's a lot of confusion about the hardiness and even basic identity of some culinary herbs. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll talk about herbs that are annual and perennial and reveal why the nomenclature can confuse even the experts. Plus answers to all your growing questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY-FM.
Yeah. I'm Ray Suarez. Coming up on America Abroad.
I said, who are the smartest guys you have who want to work on developing something that will pump water from sunshine?
Global demand for water is increasing along with the world's population, and sanitation is an issue in many places, making water management a crucial issue. The Global Water Challenge, next on America Abroad from Public Radio International.
Tomorrow night at 11 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Kevin Blyer about rewriting the U.S. Constitution. He's got a new book called Me, the People. Again, he's an award-winning writer for The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. As we know, there are amendments to the U.S. Constitution, so it has been altered over these years. And let me read the Second Amendment as it is written in the U.S. Constitution. And then, Kevin, I'd like to hear your rewrite.
Alrighty.
The Second Amendment says, a well-regulated militia, comma, being necessary to the security of a free state, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, comma, shall not be infringed.
Yes, well, it is the case that that is what it says. You're right. The interpretations over the years have been kind of cloudy. The Supreme Court, of course, famously suggested that it does actually say that there's an individual right to bear arms. To do that, Justice Scalia and others have, I guess, their own rewrites of the Second Amendment. They decided to flip the clauses and explain it in more rational English what it actually means. But what I know is that if it's truly punctuation that is the issue and grammar that is the issue, and yet I feel like, well, I actually do believe there's an individual right to bear arms. I will confide in you and say that I feel that as well. I understand it. But I also know, as a human, as an American, I would love to think that we could have just at least effective enough gun control that, frankly, crazy people don't get guns and do dangerous, unfortunate things with them, as we've seen too often in the last few years. So I thought, if in fact punctuation is the issue, and punctuation leaves enough of an open window to interpret it however we might. And let me also explain quickly that I'm not the only one to write the Constitution, or excuse me, write the Second Amendment. As I said, Justice Scalia in his decision actually explained it in more common terms. There's a Tea Party endorsed Constitution named The Constitution Made Easy, written by an NRA gun instructor named Michael Holler, who actually did something similar and rewrote it as well. Very clear language to suggest that an individual has a right to bear arms.
Right.
But I suggested that, all right, if grammar and punctuation is the issue, and what we need to do is to do our best to try to find some way to make sure that people after us might interpret the Second Amendment in a way that would keep guns out of the hands of people who shouldn't have guns, the only thing I can do as a satirist is add punctuation, because I hope that other people will do it. So yes, in fact, it is the case that my Second Amendment goes a little like this: your new Second Amendment, comma, well, semicolon, regulated, exclamation point, militia, hyphen, being, comma, open parentheses, necessary, close parentheses, to, comma, the, comma, security, question mark, of, comma, a, comma, free, ellipses, state, comma, the, comma, well, you see where I'm going with this.
I do.
Right, ellipses, of, comma, the, comma, people, ellipses, to, comma, keep, exclamation point, and, comma, bear, question mark, arm, semicolon, shall, comma, not, comma, be, comma, infringe, question mark, exclamation point. I merely hope that being the same language, right, might itself some point suggest to the world there's got to be some way to read that to make sure that that gun violence is somehow diminished. That's the only thing I can do as a writer.
Well, it's like being a fourth grade grammar teacher to the writers of the Constitution.
Exactly.
Use your punctuation in a way that you actually intend it.
Right, exactly. And I intend to cloud the issue.
Well, you mentioned Justice Scalia, and you had what sounds like a surprise interview with Justice Scalia.
It was a bit of a surprise. I did not see it coming. I lucked into it through the good graces of a portrait artist named Nelson Shanks, master with
a
brush, a local, in fact. Yes, and I was eager, of course, to meet with Justice Scalia, because you could imagine, I thought to myself, who on the face of the planet, let alone within the confines of the country, would really be most amenable to a page one rewrite of the Constitution?
Yes.
And it would
be
the man,
Scalia, right,
who's devoted his entire life to protecting every phrase and clause from fools like me. And as you know, he's not really a man who suffers fools. But he was, in fact, very gracious, incredibly understanding of the true intent of my book, which is to get people to pay attention to the Constitution. And we did meet, and it was a fascinating lunch. I've seen him since then as well. But we talked about everything constitutional as much as we could over a lunch. And then I turned my attention to his bread and butter, the third article, the judiciary, and what I suggested other people, and perhaps I might also, the changes that people have suggested over the years about what might be changed. And I used the phrase lifetime tenure. And as soon as I said that, he took a big grin, picked up a fork, poked it in my face, and said, "Don't you dare. Right. Don't you dare change lifetime tenure."
Literally, you mean that.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, yeah, he yelled, you know, he was right. He did it with both a grin and a growl at the same time because he knew where I was headed. But he said, "If you change lifetime tenure, at least grandfather me in because I like my job."
Well, he also, and he said this to other people who have interviewed him, so, right?
Right, exactly.
It
yeah.
seems to be a response to things that he doesn't agree with.
I suppose that's case. I mean, he's basically telling you, be right. a lawyer, convince right. me. And he said it to me a few times, and I'm sure it flummoxed me, and I'm sure that I got tongue-tied, right. and I don't remember precisely what I said. But yeah, his argument is so, you know, even for example, the 5-4 decision in Gore, in Bush v. Gore, basically, so we did it. The decision's been made. Right. So now what? And that's a fair point. I mean, the judgment has been rendered, or he's saying, so what are you? How are you going to convince me that I'm either right or wrong about what I'm about to say?
And I think the story you were telling him was that while the Constitution was being written, a witch was being prosecuted
right.
or at least you know, dealt with somewhere in Philadelphia at the time.
He's known to be an originalist, certainly, and you know he often wants us to interpret the world through the mores of what might have been presumed in 1787. And I'm not the first person to point this out, but in fact, yes, at the time of 1787, they were prosecuting people for being witches still.
Yeah.
So you know he made the joke.
So?
Well, it's possible she was a witch. We don't know absolutely. So he, I mean, the other thing about Justice Scalia, famously. Great sense of humor, and it's evident, I think, in my recounting of our conversation. It's also officially the case that he is the funniest Supreme Court justice because a few years ago they did a study they basically just counted the number of times that laughter in brackets was annotated in the Supreme Court in transcripts, and by far he's the funniest Supreme Court justice, 2-1 over the next funniest, which is Justice Breyer, 19-1 over Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. We actually don't know about Clarence Thomas, because
right.
the man doesn't speak that often, so it's possible that mathematically speaking he's infinitely funny. We don't know this. But yes, he's actually a very funny guy, Scalia is, Justice Scalia, and I certainly was entertained by him and grateful that he was willing to meet with me. As I said before, I knew he was eager to meet with or willing to meet with me because he knew that the idea of the book, which is let's take some comic hay, but let's also at least get some attention to the actual Constitution itself, and I think he understood the true intent.
And I'm curious whether you tried to outfunny him, or whether it was a more sort of straight conversation.
No, it was a fairly straight conversation. I suppose I did try to outfunny him. I failed, meaning even the times, and I think any reader might see this in the account.
Right.
Any time I thought I had him, either with a judicial argument
yes.
or a piece of comedy.
Oh, you are bold.
He came back. He came back over top of me and was both funnier and also trumped me. I guarantee it. He won the day. Unfortunately for me, but perhaps fortunately for the readers of the book.
Well, that's Kevin Blyer, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about his rewrite of the U.S. Constitution and his book called Me, the People, One Man's Selfless Quest to Rewrite the Constitution of the United States of America.
And, of course, the key word there is selfless. I'm not doing this for my own health.
I get it.
I'm doing it for the
yes.
good of the country.
I realize I'm talking to a very humble person sitting across from me here. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHY. Why? You actually say some serious things. I'm sorry to say this to you and our listeners, but serious things in this book as well. And the way you describe gerrymandering, I thought really nailed it, which is of course redrawing districts every 10 years. It allows those elected members of legislatures and perhaps even the U.S. Congress to pick their voters rather than the other way around.
Right. I don't know that I'm the first person to point that out. Perhaps I am, and if I am, I'll take the credit for it. I'll take it. But you're right. Gerrymandering has gotten a little bit ridiculous. I think we can all agree with that. Anyone who looks at a district map thinks, how did this come to pass?
Exactly.
Interestingly enough, I think I had learned this in, high school. Who knows? But I had it took me to go back and do this research a decade plus later to remind myself that gerrymandering, by the way, has a fascinating genesis because I don't know where we're used to that term, gerrymandering, but But it's actually based on a gentleman named Elbridge Gerry, who was one of the delegates to the Constitutional Convention. One of his, I believe, one of his allies redesigned a district for one of his against one of his opponents when he was running for office that looked so much like a salamander that it became Gerrymander. So his name is Elbridge Gerry, right. Gerrymander. So that's pretty fascinating as well. But yes, you're right. I think the idea that the framers would be a little bit alarmed to see the maps as designed, because we have gotten to the point where now, essentially, instead of voters picking their politicians get to choose their voters after they come into office. And the amount of computation that's involved in this makes it almost impossible for anyone to basically contest a lot of these districts. And in fact, statistically speaking, I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but the number of people that actually contest these very well-designed, or I should say poorly designed, districts has fallen off the map. People just figure, what's the point? Wow. I know that the last person who basically was in charge got to pick their voters so clearly that they knew that they would be reelected. And that's just, I think, a pretty obvious negative aspect of our democracy. And I don't know exactly the solution, except, go back a few decades and say, well, what did this look like before? Right. Let's try to make it look more human, rectangular, anything. I mean, there are solutions.
Well, and I think there's some states that have non-elected officials that redraw these maps.
That's true.
I mean,
panels that are determined to do that.
Right.
But the fact that wouldn't be around everywhere is pretty alarming to me.
Well, let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Frank from Solbury joins us. And Frank, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How are you?
I am well. I'm enjoying the conversation.
Thank you.
My question has to do with the terms that congressmen, the only 2-year term and reelectability. It would seem to me that a lot of our problems have to do with, congressmen just getting in there and having term. I think the founding fathers would be just laughing at anyone wanting to be in Congress, because at the time it was written, it was you left your home, you left your family, you left your business, and no one would, in their right mind, want to do that for more than 2 years.
Fair enough, Frank.
And,
I do address term limits in the book, but I even go more bold than that, bolder than that, because here's what we know about Congress, and you're right. Congress, of course, has seen better days. That is to say, the approval rating of Congress is pretty low. I believe it was Tom Coburn who said when he learned that there were 14% of Americans that approved of Congress, even he said, who are these 14% of people who trust us? I'm not sure who they are. So, yes, we know that the approval rating is very low. We also know that people often can't name their own congressman. Yeah. So I, as you can imagine, address that real issue about how to fix Congress. But I take a pretty bold and, yes, perhaps absurd, perhaps indefensible stance that the only way we know to rectify the situation is to make every person a congressman upon birth. That way they know they'll know the name of their own congressperson, and they'll probably approve of that person as well. So at the very least, that's a band-aid. I recognize that. But you're right. Term limits are of course, something to be considered. I do argue on both sides, meaning I make the case on both sides, and I leave it to the reader to determine if it's the right way to go.
Fair enough. I thank you for calling into Radio Times, Frank. Excuse me, and you can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. So what do you have against Rhode Island?
Oh, poor Rhode Island. Yes. Well, the truth, I mean, look, I'll give away the game a little bit and say, of course I have nothing against Rhode Island. It's a glorious place, and I'm sure I'd love to retire there. I enjoy that as well. But it's not what I have against Rhode Island. It's what, unfortunately, history has against Rhode Island. You're right. I will take one step back and say one thing I do in the book, and it was inevitable. I had no choice, is to essentially rank the states.
Yes.
Prominence,
relevance, general importance,
and Texasness. Apparently, that's the Texas-ness. X factor. I'm not sure what that means exactly. Maybe a braggadocio. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But with Rhode Island, it's more specific than that. It's not just the criteria. And you're right. Those criteria are part and parcel of my rewrite of the fourth article. The fourth article, of course, is supposed to essentially referee among the states and help us all get along. And it sometimes does, but oftentimes does not succeed. So I thought, well, the only way we know we can solve this solution, we can solve this problem right now, is go ahead and decide who's in charge here. So I rank all the states. Yes, it is the fact that Rhode Island comes last. But now, it's not just because of my...
And it's tiny little lettering.
It's a tiny little state, isn't it?
Yes,
you know?
It is a tiny little state.
It's a perfectly sized lettering for the perfectly sized state. Rhode Island, you know, I just felt like, here's what I know about Rhode Island. First of all, yes, it's tiny. So there's no doubt about that. But beyond that, they were they dragged their heels for the first decades of the country. And to some degree, I was like, well, if you don't want to be part of it, then go ahead and good riddance to you. But the idea is they were supposed to show up at the Constitutional Convention, the delegates from Rhode Island. They never did. They didn't ratify it until it was clear that everyone was going to. So it was a bit of Me Too-ism.
Right.
And I thought, you know what, if you don't want to be part of our party, if you don't want to show up, then go ahead and good riddance to you. So admittedly, and you know, I hope the people and those with a sense of humor in Rhode Island will get the joke. When you ratify my Constitution, unfortunately, we're left with 49 states because Rhode Island has to move over and let Massachusetts have a little more room.
Oh, interesting. well, your list begins with New York, of course.
Naturally, right. It has to be.
Followed by California, Illinois, and then number four is Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania,
it's
absolutely.
Shout out there.
It's a shout out, and of course, you know, that's just, again, a historical element. You know, they were, Pennsylvania, where we are now, was the reason we're all here. They got it together. They a few blocks from here, as you know, this is where the men argued about what would be the country. So, of course, I have to put them in the top five.
Well, you also went to Greece, and I don't know whether you went to Greece during the Euro crisis, because this probably isn't the Greece that inspired some of the thinking that went into the U.S. Constitution.
2,500 years later, you're
yes.
right. I did go at the beginning, I suppose, of the Euro crisis, enough that when I went to Syntagma, I believe I'm pronouncing it incorrectly, I'm sure, Square, Constitution Square, where they have right outside of Parliament, I suppose you'd say, there were protests. Nothing as violent as we've seen recently. But in fact, when I went to the Acropolis, it was closed. Austerity measures had already already kicked in. I only had to wait a few more hours for it to open back up. But yes, I decided I would go back to first principles, learn what I could about Greek democracy in, a few days, so that I could have some moral authority, if not true authority, to rewrite the preamble. Because the preamble is supposedly, you know, we reach way back into antiquity to find our democratic principles. So I thought at the very least I'll do what the founders never did, by the way, which is make it all the way to Greece. Some went to Rome, but none made it to Greece. So I thought I will trump them at their own game.
About a minute before a second break here, but it's interesting that the U.S. Constitution is not the inspiring document that it was a generation or two or even before. When you see these emerging democracies, they don't necessarily turn to the U.S. Constitution.
That's correct, and it's pretty fascinating. It is the case that 25 years ago, 94%, to throw a stat out at you, of the constitutions of the world were based in part, at least, on the American Constitution. In the last 25 years, apparently none of them have explicitly based their constitution on ours. So yeah, it needs a little good publicity. I mean, no less than Justice Ginsburg was in Egypt 2 months ago and said if she were redesigning a democracy now, she wouldn't use the American Constitution as a model. And I thought, you know what, somebody should cheerlead for this thing, so I'll give it my best.
And that is Kevin Blyer, our guest today on Radio Times, and his rewrite of the U.S. Constitution is called Me the People, and he joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. He is an award-winning writer for The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. He has also worked with President Obama on some of those humorous speeches he's given at the Correspondents' Dinner. We're going to talk a little bit more about that after this very short break, including a play some of those clips from some of those speeches and take some calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
This is Jeff Bundy, WHYY's Director of Member Relations. On August 3rd, WHYY-TV and PBS stations across the country will be premiering a new documentary produced locally by WHYY. The Barnes Collection tells the story of Dr. Albert C. Barnes and his impressive art collection. Support WHYY's local productions with a $120 donation and we'll thank you by sending you two tickets to visit the Barnes Foundation's new home on the Ben Franklin Parkway. Call 1-888-345-9499 or visit WHYY.org.
On the next Fresh Air, the AIDS epidemic in the African American community.
If Black America were a nation separate and apart, its HIV infection rates would rival that of many nations in sub-Saharan Africa.
We'll talk with public health analyst Dr. Robert Fullilove and Renata Simone, the director of the new PBS Frontline documentary, Endgame. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young from Public Radio's Daytime News Magazine, Here and Now. We bring you the news that happens between the morning headlines and the afternoon wrap-up, plus conversations with authors and music makers, stories that affect you, maybe a story about you. So please join us for Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture, Here and Now. Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Kevin Blyer. He's an Emmy Award-winning writer for The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. He also was a writer and producer for Politically Incorrect with Bill Maher and also wrote for Dennis Miller. And he rewrote the U.S. Constitution. Me the People is the book. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. He also got a job right out of college working for NPR. An intern?
Yeah, basically a PA. Worked for the London Bureau of Marketplace Radio for a few months. And, of course, when I say the London Bureau, I mean the host's two-bedroom apartment on Whittlesey Street. See, of course, yes, indeed.
So how did you get into comedy writing per se?
You know, I don't have the pithiest answer for that, but I can tell you what happened is that I actually thought that I had romantic ideas of actually being a war correspondent, being, as they say, a real journalist. You couldn't certainly at the time major in fake journalism. Perhaps you can now. I'm not sure how that works. You couldn't major in, there was no college major of satire, so
yes,
to speak. But having done it now for 15 and a half years, I'm thrilled in retrospect to look at it and think that all made some sense. I have enjoyed it. But I wanted to be a war correspondent, actually in some far-flung, war-torn region. It is amusing to me that that never came to pass, in part because I got a job writing for Bill Maher, and I really enjoyed
that
and
though?
Stayed there for a number of years. Well, actually, I was, like I said, I had been working for NPR, and then there was when David Brancaccio became the host of Marketplace, he moved out to Los Angeles, and I followed him a few months later, thought, well, I'm in LA, maybe I'll look into television a bit too.
It just happened to be that
the first job, I was a writer's assistant,
yes,
on Politically Incorrect for a couple years before they promoted me to writer. But it does amuse me that even though I still at that time thought, you know, I'm going to go off and do the real deal at some point, that many years later, it took the fact that I was actually working for The Daily Show in 2007 to finally go overseas and do a few pieces about the Iraq War in the middle of August in 2007, right during the surge. And of course, as we were flying around a couple times in Black Hawk helicopters, I thought to myself, how hilarious is it that it came to pass that I had to work essentially for a satirical show to at least dip into what I thought might be my dream a decade previous. Indeed.
Well, let me give a shout out to The Daily Show, and I've done it on other shows. It's not just that you're sitting across from me, but at the same time, I think The Daily Show, The Colbert Report, use satire in a very. I mean, I think people should major in satire because you have a lot to work with. But nonetheless, to me, it's one of the most kind of insightful analysis of not just journalism, but also news, politics, politicians.
Well, we try to get it right. What can I say? I mean, we obviously want to entertain. There's no doubt about that. We want to make people laugh. There's no doubt about that. That's the genesis of the show. That's what our North Star is, certainly.
Yes.
Over the years, you know, John and his genius has kind of turned this into a bit of an analysis show as well, and tried to make a point through comedy And, you know, we benefit from the fact that we are not on 24 hours a day. We are lucky there. We know that we can take a moment, take a breath, really look at the news and try to do something interesting with it, even if that means, you know, using puppets or punchlines.
Well, or using old tape I mean, it seems like these two shows are especially skilled at showing up people's hypocrisies by literally digging back in the archives and finding the opposite thing that someone just said.
I suppose that's true. It's that crazy gotcha journalism we subscribe to. True. but you're right. We try to, you know, we benefit again from having a staff that has their radar up, that knows, you know, what to look for, how to look for it, to know when something is clearly somewhat hypocritical. We'll of course address that if a politician is saying something that they directly said otherwise a week ago, a year ago, 5 years ago. If it's relevant and important that it be pointed out, then we'll do that. We don't take it lightly. We don't just point out anything just because, heck, it's worth pointing out. We try to find the important issues, and then, of course, at that point, do the best we can to make it entertaining and the least amusing.
You watch a lot of TV as a writer for Jon Stewart?
You bet. We have to. We all do.
Again,
occupational hazard of feeling like one eyeball is always on a television screen.
Yeah.
It's soul deadening. I tell you that, but nonetheless, it's an interesting way to make a living. Right. Certainly, yeah.
Well, and thinking about how writers work together, there are those, you know, the movies, the stereotypes. Is it literally in a room batting ideas around?
Yeah, I mean,
using each other as kind of an audience, a test case.
It's not wizardry. It's exactly what you'd anticipate it might be. A bunch of people paying attention to the news, getting together a few times during the day, discussing what we should say, what's important. And yes, admittedly, what footage is out there. We have to screen a lot of footage. And if we've been screaming at the television screen enough and we can find some way to translate that anger and frustration into smiles and happiness, then we'll do our best to do that, and that becomes the first and second segments of the show. It's a bunch of people who've gotten together and decided this is what we're going to do for the day.
Wow. And how did you end up writing for President Obama?
Oh, well, you know, I was honored to be asked.
And his office directly asked you?
Well, I mean, there have been writers for presidential jokes for, you know, history. Every president has had people kind of step in, and perhaps, you know, throw some things across the transom and see if they are entertained by it enough to use it in his words. They have, of course, an incredibly talented speechwriting staff at the White House, all of whom are actually, obviously, as you can imagine, they, like we on The Daily Show, I suppose, are, you know, they're facile with their ability to write in a person's voice.
Yes.
They do that for the president. I've done that for John and others. Honored to do it. And yes, when they know that they need to do more than a couple jokes, they are happy to have, I think, some assistance. And so when it looked like the president was going to become the president, and in fact, and it looked like in their calendar they had a bunch of black-tied dinners where they knew they had to give a 30-minute speech rather than a 3-minute speech that had to be funny, I'm happy to hear them, you know, email me and say, "You got anything funny for us?"
And is that how it works, email, or do you go to the White House? Sit with the president?
No. Like I said, they have a speechwriting staff. This is merely an occasional call, but happy to do it. But it's there's no rhyme or reason as far as actually how it gets put together necessarily.
Well, I do want to play, and this is from the 2011 Correspondents' Dinner. And this is President Obama joking about Donald Trump and the birther controversy and Trump's work on Celebrity Apprentice. This is the president speaking. Let's listen.
No one is happier, no one is prouder to put this birth certificate matter to rest than the Donald. And that's because he can finally get back to focusing on the issues that matter. Like, did we fake the moon landing? What really happened in Roswell? And where are Biggie and Tupac? All kidding aside, obviously we all know about your credentials and breadth of experience. For example, just recently, in an episode of Celebrity Apprentice, at the steakhouse, the men's cooking team did not impress the judges from Omaha Steaks.
And there was a lot of blame to go around, but you, Mr. Trump, recognized that the real problem was a lack of leadership. And so ultimately, you didn't blame Little John or Meatloaf. You fired Gary Busey. And these are the kind of decisions that would keep me up at night.
And that's from the 2011 Correspondents' Dinner, getting a rousing applause. And Kevin, as I was listening to that, I was remembering how uncomfortable Donald Trump looked while the president was really skewering him.
Well, I think people were surprised that he was there because he had to know something was coming. Famously, that was the week that after being badgered by a number of people, Trump most significantly, I suppose, about whether or not he was going to release his birth certificate. That was the week that the president actually released the long form birth certificate, as I recall, or the birth certificate anyway. So it was fraught. There was certainly a sense of the president's going to say something, and that's what he said. And of course, that was also the same weekend, famously, that he had only hours before and after been working hard on a very significant piece, a matter of national security, which of course was the Navy SEALs team, the Navy SEALs team getting Osama bin Laden. So that was truly one of the most amazing weekends of the nation's history, let alone the president's. And certainly, I found it fascinating to watch from a complete objective observer standpoint as well.
Did you author any of what we heard there? Or it doesn't work that way.
It doesn't work that. Of course, you know, I can't answer that. That's again, it's even for any speechwriter's code, you can't of course claim which things might have been yours. So I'll have to punt on that one. Forgive me.
But it is interesting, and we hear the delivery, the timing. Writing for the president and writing for Jon Stewart. Very different. Obviously, very different settings. But
to some degree, a joke is a joke.
Yes, exactly.
The topics might be different. The angle of attack might be different. The point you're trying to make might be different, and the acerbic element of it might be different. I think to some degree, you can look at a joke and say, well, that's funny or it's not funny. I know that both John and the president, of course, are happy to kind of puncture the balloon, that is to say, address the thing that might be most fraught, as I said before, but needs to be addressed in order to relieve the pressure. And so I think that's something that we do on The Daily Show. I think that's something the president enjoys doing as well, to kind of say, if I can make fun of this, then at least for the next 20 seconds, we're all going to be okay. And I think he's done that a number of times.
And do you get exhausted? obviously you have to.
In general, in life?
Well, yes, of course. Well, just the kind of intensity of that kind of work, of having to deliver those lines.
I'm lucky in that the Daily Show is an incredibly well-oiled machine.
Right.
A lot of people that are good at their jobs, and comes from the top. And so it is exhausting, but it doesn't overwhelm my life, because I'm saying that the job is somewhat of a 9-to-5, as much as it can be. Well, I just mean, we get in, we get out. Granted, you kind of live and breathe it anyway. You get home and watch more television and you think, well, what can I do with this?
Yes, exactly.
But I think, like I said, I'm lucky that it comes from the top, that it's a very sane, civil place to be.
Well, let's get some callers back in on the conversation. Looks like they want to talk about the U.S. Constitution.
Oh, fair enough.
Fair enough. And we have, looks like, Yvonne from Northeast Philadelphia. And go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Oh, hi, Marty.
Hi there.
I have an idea for an amendment to the Constitution.
Please.
Oh, great.
It just seems to me that few of us have felt any impact from the wars our country has been fighting over the last 10 years. And I also believe that the barrier to war is much too low. So my amendment would read as such, there shall be a tax on the people during times of war.
That makes a lot of sense.
Right.
Go ahead.
Well, let me tell you, a couple thoughts. One is that, first of all, there's a paperback version. So I would hope that people would send me all sorts of ideas that I might be able to include in a new foreword. For that matter, as I said, Thomas Jefferson suggested that this thing should be rewritten every 19 years. So, heck, you can take it from 19 years from now if you can look that far in the future. I do think that's an interesting idea. There have been those who have said that, we look at our Congress especially. It doesn't actually represent the average population, because so few of those family members within Congress have people that have had to make sacrifices for it. There are some, and of course they should be, you know, applauded for kind of having that vested interest. But I think what you're saying is that we need to find some way to make us realize when we're at war, whether or not that be monetary or just some more indicative way of suggesting to the world, you know, the binary light is on. We are actually at war, and we need to remember that in our daily, as we go through the day. I think I would imagine you'd have a hard sell in actually selling a
because
tax
of the
for
word
war,
tax.
Because of the word tax, especially in this day and age. Not merely because of the controversy of last week as well, but in general. I mean, as you know, we're not really as a country at this point. We're not really eager, I think, to give away more of our pocketbook these days. And again, arguments on both sides as to whether or not that's fortunate or unfortunate.
Yvonne, thanks for the call. Let me squeeze John from Mount Airy on Radio Times. And John, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. I used to work for an organization that, as a history teacher, I talked to people from different countries about the Constitution. And the question I regularly got was, what do I think is unique about the Constitution?
Hmm. Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I think is pure genius about the Constitution is that in theory, we have an independent court system, that we have a Supreme Court that, at least as the Constitution is written, is not beholden to any person, is
right.
not beholden to a religion, is not beholden to a political party, although there weren't political parties when the Constitution
sure,
was written.
Sure.
So how did you approach that in your rewrite of the Constitution?
Well, absolutely.
John, thanks for the call.
That's actually the argument, as you say, for example, lifetime tenure, because, English kings would somewhat willy-nilly remove judges from the bench for any sorts of reasons. So while I comically suggested to the Justice Scalia that perhaps lifetime tenure might be revisited for a bunch of good reasons too, but you're precisely addressing the reason that so many people say lifetime tenure is absolutely a benefit, because mm-hmm. it does make them truly independent in ways that history hadn't really seen many times over. And you're right, that is certainly one of the ways that our Constitution is unique.
John, thanks for the call to Radio Times. We're almost out of time, but what is a term member of the Council on Foreign Relations?
Oh, it just means that I'm a kid. I'm a youthful.
I sit at the kids' table at those dinners, basically.
That's all that means, indeed. It means we get to go. It means I, and this is what I certainly enjoy it for, get to go and listen to very interesting people give talks on very interesting things I get to enjoy it as a kind of a speaker's bureau with that element, you know, because I get to really be entertained by the quality and quantity of people that come through the council, and I get to hear them talk over a meal.
Well, Kevin Blyer, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
It's been my pleasure.
And the book is called Me, the People, One Man's Selfless Quest to Rewrite the Constitution of the United States of America. And again, he's an Emmy Award-winning writer for The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, has written for President Obama, and as I said, he is a term member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoe, and thank you so much for joining us. If you want to